सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
अस्सलाम वालेकुम, वेलकम बैक टू सोच विचार। टुडे आई एम वेरी प्लीज्ड एंड ऑनर्ड टू अनाउंस दैट वी हैव अ वेरी फेमस एकेडेमिक फ्रॉम पाकिस्तान, प्रोफेसर आयशा जलाल। I think she is extremely well known. I don't have to really introduce her, but just for the sake of completion, let me say that Aisha Jalal is one of our leading historians. Her work on Pakistan and Indian subcontinental history has been path-breaking. She has held several professorships in the US, currently a professor at Fletcher School. Aisha is also something that should be mentioned, which very few people know here. Aisha is the recipient of a very famous award, which is called the MacArthur Genius Fellowship. And I think that is something that she and we should all be very proud of. So I'm very happy to welcome you, Aisha.
I'm delighted to be with you.
And I just want to say, Aisha, that this podcast that I mentioned to you is meant for, this is not meant to compete with the entertainment channels. This is meant for the serious listener, especially for students and researchers who are thinking of doing some serious work. So thank you very much for joining us, Aisha. Let me begin by asking you, Aisha, your first book where you became very famous and well-known was The Sole Spokesman. Could you sort of give, I'm sure many of our students may not have read this, etc. Could you just give a brief introduction? I know it's a very big book and it's very well researched and, you know, a complex book, but it's whatever you can tell us in a brief few minutes to begin the kick off the discussion.
Well, I mean, substantively, the argument was that, you know, I mean, I began that book with the question, how did a Pakistan come about that satisfied the interests of its main constituents so poorly? Punjab and Bengal, the two main Muslim-majority provinces, got divided, partitioned, provinces that Muslims might have wished to dominate in an undivided sense. And Muslims in the rest of India were left high and dry. And those Muslims, as some may know, were amongst the most ardent supporters of Pakistan, the Pakistan movement. So that was the guiding question. And my research, I was fortunate to have access to newly opened documents from the British sources. I was able to look at Muslim League sources, as well as some Congress sources. And the result was that I discovered that one of the great errors that we make is to assume that the end result, i.e. the Pakistan that emerged in 1947, was the Pakistan that was the Pakistan Mr. Jinnah and the Muslim League were after. And in the process of doing the research, it became clear that that was an error, and that while Mr. Jinnah wanted a Pakistan, he certainly didn't want, as he put it, a mutilated, moth-eaten Pakistan, which is exactly what emerged in 1947. So as a result of that, I showed why Mr. Jinnah's larger aims, which were to get an undivided Punjab and Bengal for the Muslim League's Pakistan, basically went awry. What were the reasons? And I think there, the end result that emerges, the larger point that emerges is that if one foregrounds the religious factor alone at the expense of everything else, you basically miss the main dynamic, which was the regional dynamic. And so effectively, when you factor in the regional dynamic, you discover that for all the assertions of Muslim unity, Muslim community, Muslims were never really united in their politics. And Mr. Jinnah had to negotiate the varying dynamics in Muslim majority and minority provinces. And at the end of the day, his desire to have undivided Punjab and Bengal clashed with his insistence that the Pakistan demand was an exclusively Muslim demand, and a demand that was being raised for the sake of Muslim self-determination. He couldn't quite demand self-determination for Muslims and deny it to non-Muslims living in Punjab and Bengal, which is what Congress did, was to basically partition those two provinces. And that took away a whole slice of Mr. Jinnah's bargaining capacity, because once Punjab and Bengal got divided, he couldn't really make claims on behalf of Muslims left behind in India. And he had envisaged Pakistan to be a kind of an umbrella that would cover the interests of all Muslims in India, not only those who became citizens of Pakistan, but those who would remain part of Hindustan. So basically, that's the story. I don't know whether that makes any sense to you, but that's
essentially
the main
of my work. No, that's wonderful. Essentially, what you're saying is it's a complex story of Muslim identity and Muslim feeling of a possible discrimination, which was sort of kind of interwoven into the Indian regional dynamics. And eventually, it was very hard to extricate the two communities, and we got into this mess. But then later, Aisha, you went into another interesting book, where you, which I think brings us closer to a contemporary world. Democracy and Authoritarianism in South Asia, a Comparative and Historical Perspective. Now, there I think you struggle more with after what happened in partition and why we are where we are. What is your perspective there?
Well, yes, you're right. Even though I must say, Nadeem, that I do think that even Soul Spokesman has contemporary relevance. If you see what's happening in India today, with Muslims practically disenfranchised in the UP as a result of politics. But I won't go there, but I will answer your question on democracy and authoritarianism. I did a book in between The Soul Spokesman and Democracy and Authoritarianism, which was called The State of Martial Rule, The Origins of Pakistan's Political Economy of Defense. Where I was curious to understand why the military dominated Pakistani politics. And so I did that work. And after doing that, I was curious to understand why Pakistan, I mean, it's a curious question. The question I begin with is, how is it that two states that emerge out of the same British Indian context, one ends up establishing a workable parliamentary democracy, while Pakistan becomes... the democracy not only goes out off the rails very soon, but Pakistan becomes dominated by the military. So I wanted to understand to what extent this democracy versus authoritarianism was a contrast that made sense and why this had happened. In the process of doing that, I made a distinction between democracy as a formal, a formal democracy, by which I mean elections are held on a fairly regular basis. There's a system of parliamentary democracy, but most states also have a covert authoritarianism rooted in them, and that's basically there in the form of the army, the police, etc., and paramilitary forces. So it was a question of understanding the balance in India. I basically felt that the overwhelming focus of political scientists on the Congress party was not giving the whole story, and you had to bring in the dimension of the covert authoritarianism that also exists in India, especially if you consider that in India over long stretches of time, you've had an elected government at the federal center, but you've had entire regions that have been under authoritarian rule. In other words, they've been governed by the governors or by the army. I mean, look at Kashmir, look at Assam in the past, Punjab in the more distant past. So what I'm trying to get at is that it was these dynamics that led me to look at a comparative study of not just Pakistan and India, but also Bangladesh, even though Bangladesh doesn't get as much time as India does. So that was the effort to understand how different these two countries really were. And whilst there's no denying that a formal democracy is vastly different from an authoritarian context, I think when you go beyond the sort of the broad strokes and look at the details, you begin to see that in the function, they're both post-colonial states. Let's not forget that India, the Indian Constitution, three quarters of the Indian Constitution is straightforward Government of India Act of 1945, which Congress leaders had dismissed as a charter of slavery, as retrograde, that becomes the basis of the post-colonial state. And it's worth reminding people that the Government of India Act is basically also the basis of Pakistan's constitution.
This has been a major source of, consternation and discussion in throughout the subcontinent, but especially in Pakistan. The question that you're trying to raise and the question that you research is a fundamental question that we kind of debate every day on television. That why is it that India is now with Modi coming in, we'll qualify that, but still a functioning democracy. And why is it that Pakistan is having such a hard time getting there? But the even more fundamental question is, why is it that both countries copied the 1935 Act, the Government of India Act, and never really contemplated any constitutional improvements that might strengthen democracy?
I think that's a very, very important question. And I can say that in the first instance, it was a matter of convenience. The post-colonial transition had to be hastened, not least on account of the dislocations of partition, the violence of partition, as Sardar Vallabhbhai Patel, Congress's iron man, I would say, put it. The first responsibility of a civilized government was law and order. And so the constitution that was most easily available was that was the 1935 Act. And so it was adapted by the Congress to suit its purposes. Pakistan took 9 years, largely because of issues of representation for East Pakistan or East Bengal, to be more precise in that context. And the question of the role of the religious leaders who demanded a sort of veto power. And that was resisted in the 56 Constitution. But the question is, why did India become so different if there were so many similarities? I think that, as you know, that constitutions, to quote a military dictator of Pakistan, are pieces of paper that they can be torn up at will. It's a question of implementation. And unfortunately, the 56 Constitution was eventually passed, but didn't last. By 58, you had a military coup. So it's the emergence of the military as the dominant institution that has been the primary factor in Pakistan's history. And I know that happened against the backdrop of Cold War politics, India being a larger country and having a leader like Jawaharlal Nehru at the helm, who was committed to the idea of non-alignment, resulted in a scenario where Pakistan slips into the Anglo-American embrace with a series of pacts, CETO, CENTO, American Mid-Security Alliances, becomes the conduit for, receives military aid after 54 from the Americans, which bolsters the military considerably vis-a-vis the civilian leaders. Now, the roots of that can be traced to the Kashmir conflict. So the imbalance that is created very early on works in the favor of the non-elected institutions, most notably the civil bureaucracy and the military. Whereas in India, India not only as being a larger entity, not only sort of is able to shun the Anglo-American bloc and its demands, but under Nehru, elections are held. Pakistan holds its first election, as you know, on the basis of universal adult franchise as late as 1970. Whereas by then, India has got elections in 52, in 57, in 62, in 60, at least four times.
Well, Aisha, I think there's another thing that in the popular debate, that's why we want your opinion on it, because you know the best of all that people that I know. The popular debate says that one of the reasons that the army came in is because there was such an intellectual vacuum or a political vacuum, because our leadership after Jinnah was incapable of providing leadership at a political level and bringing things to a consensus, and therefore the military had to step in. Whereas India had that depth of leadership that could allow democracy to function. What role did that play?
I think these are subjective interpretations. Mm-hmm. If you go back to the historical drawing boards of history, you begin to look at Congress and its politics in the immediate aftermath of partition. And you'll be surprised to see that the leadership quality was only marginally better in India. But India inherited institutions. Pakistan started from scratch. It had to create a new center. And so the imbalance really stems from that more than anything else. Okay. You can't simply say that it was the quality of leadership. It was not just the quality of leadership. The Congress was indeed a much more effective party organization. It had a federal structure, which facilitated India's federal orientation, despite the fact that India was being run as a unitary state, effectively. But I don't think that the notion that the military somehow was superior than the politicians. I mean, this was basically a product of the interplay of domestic, regional, and international compulsions, the most important being the Cold War, that gave the military and civilian bureaucracy the opportunity to forge links with the centers of the international capitalist system and basically take Pakistan into an era of mass. Before it got into the era of mass politics, they wanted to depoliticize Pakistan. So I don't quite agree. I think that
That's interesting. So what you're saying is that that's a very interesting perspective, and please explore this a little more. What you're saying is basically, if I hear you right, that we had, let's bring in this guy, Hamza Alavi, who said something about the state in post-colonial societies where you had a military bureaucratic complex that was trained by colonialism, ready to interlocute with the rest of the world, kind of globalized, kind of ready to take modern action. And then you have the rise of the international agencies or the international world, the new globalized world, where development was coming to the fore, and these guys began to find kinship, and they began to develop a local dialogue based on development, which is devoid of politics, and kind of marginalize the politicians. Is that a correct reading of what you're saying, or would you like to elaborate on that?
I don't agree with Mr. Alavi. Mr. Okay. Alavi's idea of the overdeveloped state may have some merit, mm-hmm. but where it falters entirely in my inquiry between mm-hmm. why India and Pakistan developed so mm-hmm. differently mm-hmm. in the aftermath of partition mm-hmm. and independence mm-hmm. is that the overdeveloped idea would have to operate in India as well. Mm-hmm. How come India does not fall into the military authoritarian context as Pakistan does? Uh-huh. So I think that overdeveloped state has to be in India as well. He can't simply wipe that away. There is no explanatory value there in terms of a comparative understanding of India and Pakistan. Even if the state was overdeveloped vis-a-vis civil society, then that operated in India as well.
I think what most people would argue is it's a narrow factor. It's a narrow factor, the Patel factor. That's why they're saying that there's a breadth of Indian leadership that was capable of kind of fighting off the military bureaucratic complex, which we didn't have here.
Well, fine, but I mean, the overdeveloped state was in India much more so than in Pakistan. You had to the civil bureaucracy had to be rebuilt from scratch. You got a divided army in Pakistan. So I just don't think that this is an adequate explanation. He's undermining his own argument. If you say that in the case of India, it was a civilian leadership, then there was no overdeveloped state. I mean, civilians could counter the overdeveloped state mm-hmm. argument, but not in Pakistan. So I do think that this is a major flaw. Okay. I don't agree with it. Okay. I think it has to have value for. This is a post-colonial state that emerges out of the British Indian state system. Okay. It's overdeveloped for both, not just for one or the other.
Fine. That's a fair point, and that should be taken into account. But let's look at it another way. I mean, as you said, that Pakistan lacked the institutions. India inherited the institutions. Yes, India inherited the capital, and along with the capital, all kinds of stuff that goes in a capital, which Pakistan didn't have, and we had to freshly create everything in a haste in Karachi. But India also, over time, developed, it inherited a better setup, but nevertheless, let's put it this way, Indian academics are far stronger than Pakistan. Is there a reason for that?
Indian academics are what?
Far stronger than Pakistan.
Of course. I mean, but that again is a comment on the educational institutions. I mean, Pakistan did a much quicker and effective hatchet job on the education institutions.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if one studies the way, I remember writing State of Martial Rule and talking about the Rawalpindi conspiracy case and saying that this was a turning point which turned Pakistan into a intellectual wasteland.
Mm-hmm.
That may be an overstatement on the benefit of hindsight, but nevertheless, it was a very significant difference between India and Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, whatever you may say about Nehru and the linkage between Nehruvian ideals and the Indian academic circles is very strong, especially the socialist. In fact, what you're witnessing today, Nadeem, is a reaction to all to that Nehruvian elite.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that that helped India's education institutions survive much longer than ours.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to be underscored.
Mm-hmm. I mean, in a sense, Nehru, for example, I think two main innovations of Nehru that I admire and wonder about, that he created the IITIMs when all of us were trying to buy wheat and, you know, do all kinds of things on aid. But he forced aid to create those things. And then he created this thing that I always marvel at when I go to Delhi. It's the India International Center in the middle of Lodhi Gardens, which is like an intellectual hangout, which kind of creates a lot of sort of intellectual debate. And so I think, quite frankly, maybe Nehru did have an impact on education. And has the education debate in India contributed in any way to the strengthening of democracy?
Well, I think it has quite considerably. I mean, if we look at the weight of Indian academic production from 47 to, I would say, well into the 80s and beyond, I do think that they have been pivotal in terms of sustaining the intellectual debate in favor of a secular India, an inclusive India, which may, in its claims to inclusiveness, yet produce exclusivity for large communities like the Muslims and the Sikhs in certain senses. But nevertheless, the ideological weight of Nehruvian secularism has been provided by academicians.
Mm-hmm. 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 So, Aisha, I mean, tell me a couple of things. Many things come to mind on this discussion, but let me sort of direct you more towards the contemporary world. So, although much of what you said has implications there, but let's now focus on that a little. Your reading of history, what sort of light does it shine on our problems today? And what solutions, I wouldn't say even say solutions, I would just say, what kind of issues do you think that we should discuss, debate, and talk about?
I mean, it depends. I mean, I think that there are three sets of things, I would say, at three levels. I mean, one, of course, is domestic.
Mm-hmm.
But I would begin with partition and the implications of that. And I would say that the regional relationship with India is just absolutely appalling.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that Pakistan can't be blamed for it entirely because it takes two hands to clap. But that has been one of the major problems. The India factor has, in my honest opinion and my assessment as a historian, been a major has been detrimental to the burgeoning and not to mention consolidation of democracy in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
Because the moment you try and encourage critical thought, somebody will step forward and say this undermines Pakistan's security interests, and that's the end of the debate. You must remember one thing, that in the immediate aftermath of partition, when Pakistan was not expected to survive, one of the main things that happened was precisely that the Kashmir factor. It was a civilian decision to put in a claim for Kashmir, but that played a very crucial role ultimately, together with pro-American policies in shifting the balance in favor of the military and the civil bureaucracy. And frankly, since then, that became the security paradigm. Pakistan has never been able to change that, because after 1958, the military became dominant. Of course, the military becomes dominant as early as 1953, as I have shown and argued. But after 1958, it's been very difficult for Pakistan. And this is, I think you'll agree, Nadeem, that once the military takes over, you've done a lot of work on Nigeria and many other places. Once the military takes over, it becomes very difficult to make the transition back to democracy. So I think Pakistan has struggled there in large part. And this is something that we need to revisit and understand, that, you know, even the military can't really govern Pakistan unless the military wants to set up institutions for governance within its own ambit. I don't see how the military is not equipped to do that. So as a result, it undermines the functioning of the state, the lack of balance between civil and military arms of the state. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
I know, I do. But the thing
and is, I think it's connected to the Indian factor. And sorry, go ahead.
No, but okay. But what I was going to sort of try to explore there is that, yes, of course, the military has played a very big role. But then, quite frankly, the rest of society has been kind of passive and not pushed back very hard. And I'm not thinking in terms of any physical thing. I'm thinking in terms of ideas, for example. And that's what always surprises me, that the military comes, let's say Ayub Khan comes in, and Ayub Khan brings in a whole development ideology and a whole set of ideas, which I must say, were quite modern for that time. But really, there was no pushback from the rest of society at all. Then came along Bhutto. He pushed back and he won, and he did establish a whole new ethos. Then came Zia, and the Islamization of Zia, I don't see any real ideas floating around that would challenge him. There's a very small group of...
I tend to disagree. I mean, I think if you read
my
book, Structure for Pakistan, I think resistance has been one consistent theme in military authoritarian Pakistan.
Okay.
But with the difference that, you know, a military institution is a much more coherent organization. Whatever differences of opinion may exist, they act together. Mm-hmm. This is, of course, not true of the political arena, especially if the main driving factor there is regional interests, where there's regionalism. So as a result, weak political party structures, which is what Pakistan inherited at the time of its independence, were perpetuated and kept weakened by a overbearing civil bureaucracy and military. Because I don't think we can just talk of the military. In Pakistan, there was a partnership between the civil bureaucracy and the military that emerged. Just as in India, there was a partnership between the political parties and the political leadership and the civil bureaucracy and the military, where the leaders were dominant because they derived legitimacy from regular elections. But not so in Pakistan. The politicians were more divisive and could be divided, manipulated, as happened. So I do think that is the reason why there is this imbalance that I'm talking about in Pakistan and the difference with India.
Here I want to bring you to another one of your works, which is Manto's Life. You wrote about that too, and that's fascinating. But I think what I want to draw out of that, maybe extending it a little or whatever, but I think to weave it into the conversation. Then here you portray, or actually do a biographical analysis of Manto, but really with a view to explore the political dimensions of that individual's life. And I think that kind of gets at Pakistan too. Here is an intellectual of giant proportions, and how he spends his life and the frustration that he experiences and all that, I think has a lot to say about us too. So how would you throw that in as somebody who tried to play around with various intellectual and literary concepts, came into controversial position many times, and then kind of, I don't know how to characterize it, didn't really die a happy man. Does that have any political ramifications?
Yeah.
Or does that have anything to tell us about our society?
Of course it does. But let's not forget, he's a bit like Ustad Mangu at one metaphorical level, one can say, remember his Naya Kanoon. His short story Naya Kanoon about the Tangewala, Ustad Mangu, who thinks that Nayi Constitution aa gayi hai. So we are all free. So he then encounters a British army who had sworn at him and abused him ages ago. So he starts beating him up, lands up in jail, and says, "But the law has changed." And the policeman said, "What law? What are you talking about? Nothing has changed." So I think Manto is basically a very good example of the continuity of the colonial state into the post-colonial context. You have to remember that he was booked by the colonial state for obscenity. For his stories,
exactly.
Boo, odor, and dhuan. And the same law was used, ironically enough, in the post-colonial context as well. So the continuity is very sharp. But what was lacking is that the newly established state of Pakistan that emerged in ways that I have just described earlier in my comments was basically not even on its feet. And he constantly felt, I mean, there was no film industry. I mean, that had been his sustenance in Bombay, which he left to come to Lahore for family reasons, and then couldn't really find his feet here. Started writing for Imrose, The Odd Piece. His stories were, I mean, the first short story he wrote was Thanda Ghosh, which was basically banned, and he was charged with obscenity. So what I'm trying to get at is that there is continuity, and his situation is one. I mean, I would say one thing counterfactually to you that, you know, who knows that had Manto decided to stay in Bombay, he would not have been targeted there by Hindu right-wing elements. So let's not assume that it was just Pakistan. It's just that partition destroyed so much of his life. And yet, let's not forget, partition also made Manto, because Manto's short stories on partition basically have been the main focus of interest. I hope that this will change in the long run as people become more familiar with his corpus and read more of him. But it was just, you know, to this day, it's his short stories that are taught. Toba Tek Singh, Tatwal Ka Kutta. I mean, these are the stories that are being taught in the academy in the West. This is what has made Manto what he is, a phenomena. The partition stories, his even-handedness, impartial accounts of what really happened. And capturing of the human dimension. Of course, it's not unusual for you know, the personal to be overwhelmed by such moments of dislocation. And I think Manto's story is one of them.
But I should think about it another way. What if I take the metaphor of Manto and apply it to the intellectual in Pakistan? Does the story of Manto sort of kind of translate into a larger metaphor for the story of intellectual in Pakistan?
I think it does. I mean, I hesitate to see him. I think he's a creative writer more than an intellectual. I mean, but of course, intellect comes in very much. Yeah. But if you look at the whole story of the progressive writers movement, if I may be allowed to digress a bit and say that if you look at the progressive writers movement, what happened? The coercive post-colonial state. I mean, basically intervene. I mean, it basically intervened into the progressive. I mean, they infiltrated the Progressive Writers Association and made sure that it not only split, but your intellectuals also joined hands with the state or whoever was in power. So there, I mean, I don't see Manto as an intellectual in that sense. He certainly couldn't be swayed by the state. And so I think that it's a partial story because there were intellectuals who chose to work on the side of the state and undermined, in this instance, people who were not prepared to accept official ideologies of the state.
Okay, fair enough. Now, tell me, Aisha, another direction that I want to take you in is, so we've got the post-colonial state, we've got our own, the split of the partition and ramifications of that, we've got our regional dimensions, and we've superimposed all that into this multi-ethnic and multi-dimensional problem. Plus, in Pakistan, we've also got the regional situation where we are at the crossroads of the communism versus the free market, and we played all kinds of roles there. Now we are situated at a point where history has brought us to a point where I think the best way to put it is that we've got the fundamentalist rhetoric kind of on the ascendant, and the democratic situation is beginning to take root, although it's going through so many hiccups. Where do you see the future? How do you see the future evolving?
Well, I think a lot has changed. I do think that one of the main points I make in my last book, The Struggle for Pakistan, which is a general book, is that nothing that ever happens in Pakistan ever is exclusively a Pakistani phenomenon. You have to see Pakistan in the context of a changing world, and the world has changed. So we live in a world... which sort of, you know, if we look at the various phases, in many ways, this post-Cold War era, notwithstanding the fact that Cold War legacies are deeply entrenched in Pakistan, but the post-Cold War era at the global level is not conducive to the perpetuation of outright military dictatorship. Number two, there are reversals in even the promotion of this kind of militant Islam, which I attribute as early as, and which I attribute to the Saudi assertion following the quadrupling of oil prices in 1973. So my periodization takes me to 73, not to 79, which everybody cites. Mm-hmm. I think the changes really start there. Mm-hmm. The loss of East Pakistan, which transforms the whole balance of power in the region, forcing Pakistan to turn more towards its oil-rich co-religionists in West Asia, rather than continue a policy of even-handedness with Southeast Asia as well. I mean, the loss of East Pakistan basically results in an interruption of our relations with Southeast Asian nations. We become more focused for a variety of reasons, not including the nuclear program, on the Arab brothers. So I do think that was a crucial change which played a role alongside the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, American support for it, in transforming Pakistan from being, by and large, even as late as the late 70s, a relatively moderate state to one that becomes under state auspices prone to militant Islam. I think that's changing too, Nadeem, and the future suggests that too will have to be brought under control, as we are witnessing today. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be easy because it's over three decades of policies that we have to reckon with following the policy adopted by General Ziaul-Haq in supporting the Afghan Mujahideen, who was backed by America in that.
Yeah, but sorry, go ahead.
In my view, I spelled it out in my book, where I think the future is what the Pakistanis want it to be. The fact is that I've already suggested that one of the lessons of military long spells of military dictatorship in Pakistan is that even military rulers need legitimacy. Even they need a civilian face. And so short of the military deciding to govern Pakistan across the board by training its men to do that, we are going to need a country where civilian bureaucrats do their job and the military does its and the politicians do theirs. So I do think that crisis has to be recognized. The view that the military will come and solve the problem, which was the case in the 50s, has been tried and tested and frankly failed.
But then you've got a fundamental problem here, Aisha, and this is where the state of Pakistan kind of comes to a very big crisis point. That we've tried the democratic experiment 3 or 4 times, and each time it collapses into the military rule. Partly, of course, the military gets ambitious, but partly also because the democratic establishment really does not take control of the government. Like right now, we are seeing a crisis where, the democratic state seems to be kind of laying back and only focusing on development projects, not on legislation. They don't attend parliament. They don't do any cabinet meetings. They don't take charge of, for example, when there's a fundamentalism raises its head, they just send in the military. They don't want to take charge of it. On most issues, they play dormant, or they don't actually do anything, or they're worse in government. So the popular media always gets into debate of, hey, call in the army, because these guys are not functioning. How do you reconcile that through your reading of history?
Well, I mean, my point is that this calling in the military has been tried and tested and failed. What you need to do is to build institutions, civilian institutions, elected institutions. I mean, how is it that your politicians who are dissatisfied with the existing setup prefer to hold dharnas rather than straightening things out in parliament? You need to hold your politicians accountable. The other thing I'll say, the fault here, the fault lies with the attitude of the politicians, and this is a product of military dominance in part. Mm-hmm. The second one is the attitude of the citizens of this country. Mm-hmm. I just like to give you an example of Romania. It's a small country where there was a revolution, as you know, earlier. But even recently, a couple of months ago, the elected leadership decided to bring a law. I mean, the elected leader was booked for, I mean, he was accused, he's booked for of corruption charges. So the government tried to legalize corruption, i.e. basically saying that anything under $40,000 is okay. Corruption under $40,000 is not, it's not sort of, it does not have to be sort of litigated. And the people came out on the streets. Now, the question is, where are the Pakistani people? I mean, what are they waiting for? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you can't just sort of say that there's something inherent about Pakistan. It has to be all of us are to blame for this. I do not deny the coercive apparatus of the state that has kept people off the streets. Mm-hmm. But without demanding and making your views known, nothing is going to happen here.
Fair point, fair point. But Aisha, this...
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I take your point. People came out onto the streets a number of times in our history. The most important one was when Bhutto called them out. And Bhutto called them out by offering them a vision that they bought, Roti Kapda Makan. Since then, the mullahs have called them out on the vision of Islam, and they have come out periodically. The question is that right now, I don't see a competing vision for the people. They say, we come out, what do we come out for? And I think there, the one question that I want to take you to, and it probably relates back to the intellectual question, that I don't think that there is any intellectual movement in the air that kind of develops a competing vision for Pakistan, for the people, for them to come out. And that may be a big reason. Would you agree with that? That keeps people back?
I mean, you know, there are ideas. Now, what I do want to say to you is that the great tragedy of a neoliberal world that we live in is that it's now, I mean, what was always there, hidden, is now out in, it's basically in your face. Mm-hmm. You know, the state policies are made for the rich. Taxation breaks, taxation laws are made for the rich. This is all neoliberal ideologies. Mm-hmm. Now, to say that there is nobody opposing neoliberal ideologies is quite wrong. But what you are doing is to mix ideas mm-hmm. with pure politics and power. Ideas are there, but what works in today's world are sort of methods that enable the making of lots of money by politicians, and that is what can't be bridged. But you can't accuse ideas and intellectuals of that. Mm-hmm. You see mm-hmm. what I'm trying to get at? Because what works, you have worked in government. Mm-hmm. Your sort of counter for people in government are concerned about working with politicians or whether military or civilian, who are concerned with quick results. Mm-hmm. Quick turnarounds and ideas take time to germinate. Their ideas of equity are difficult to implement. So don't confuse ideas with power politics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. Aisha, now let me take you to another direction. Recently, Shashi Tharoor has written this book about how India may have been at an advantage and had colonialism not come in. Counterfactual history would have taken us another direction. Maybe we could have been a much bigger and a better, country or at least region. So that's one competing vision. The other one is the old book, I think some time ago, maybe 10, 15 years ago, that Niall Ferguson wrote, where he said that colonialism should not be only thought of as a bad intervention. Colonialism did make a good intervention. It offered us law and a modern state and modernity, so to speak. So there's this competing sort of thing that Niall Ferguson says that, hey, colonialism was necessary to wake us up and bring us into modernity. And Shashi Tharoor is saying, no. We would have developed on our own much better if these guys have not come in. How do you reconcile these?
There's no question where I'll stand. I'll stand with Shashi on this. Mm-hmm. But I would sort of say that people who are interested in this line of mm-hmm. debate might benefit from reading some scholarship. Mm-hmm. Shashi is a popular writer. Yeah. Neil is, of course, a historian. But I would say that you read a non-historian, Partha Chatterjee. His Black Hole of Empire takes up the same argument and suggests that we would have been better off. Many other people have argued much the same. Mm-hmm. I myself tend to think that colonialism has not done any good, and to assume that Indians would not have been South Asian Indians, whatever you want to call them, would not have benefited from knowledge and technologies had they not been colonized, or laws for that matter, is completely ludicrous. So I think this is where I would completely disagree with Ferguson and side with Tharoor.
Okay, that's very good. So basically, you're saying that if left to ourselves, we would have discovered modernity, we would have discovered knowledge, we would have discovered technology. But then the counter-argument is that, hey,
We slept through
the Renaissance.
If you look at history,
The counter argument is through the Renaissance. We slept through an entire movement in the world where the world was changing and learning, and we kind of slept through.
I don't agree that we slept. The problem with your line of inquiry is that you see Europe as a model that everybody else has to follow. I mean, that's a discredited point of view, Nadi.
Okay,
totally disagree with
that. Explain that, please. Yeah.
There are other things happening in Asia. There were many things happening in Asia until the 1800s. I mean, you should read Pomeranz, Ken Pomeranz. Until the 1800s, the Great Divergence. How did this happen? It's only 200 years of European dominance. Things were happening in Asia. Different things were happening in Asia that were equally sort of interesting. What your European powers brought was war capitalism followed by industrial capitalism and acquisition of territories and their subjugation. This is something very different to the absence of ideas and new technologies. In their different ways these were happening. So I don't quite agree that we have what I don't agree with is that just because Europe had a reformation, Europe had this, that, or the other, we haven't had it. You're still, every context, every country, every region has its own dynamics and its own mixture of factors, some very positive and some not. Look at China. China is, you need to bring China and South Asia. It's big enough. Many things were going on in China in the 17th century. India in the 17th century was the major exporter of cotton textiles. The world had a craze for cotton textiles. All that was changed by the colonial powers, notably the English East India Company. So I do think that we need to take that account and not sort of say that Europe did this and we don't do this. I think this is a false.
But let me push back with another popular perception. Let me push back with another popular perception.
Okay.
What we discuss in sort of everyday conversations, that when, for example, Shah Jahan was building the Taj Mahal, Europe was building universities, and as this another economic historian, I don't know if you read him or not, is Joel Mokyr, who writes The Culture of Growth, and he says that Europe had a republic of letters where intellectuals were talking to each other, and they fomented the change for cultural revolution and the Enlightenment, etc., etc. So the question is that there's a very big literature out there, especially the economic history, the kind of, and I yield to you are the expert, I'm not, I just casually read the stuff, that that there is an intellectual foment that led to both the rise of democracy as well as the rise of technology, and that intellectual foment was kind of fostered by intellectuals who had the time and the space to be able to do intellectual work, and many of them were being patronized by the state. So in a sense, the state started to develop the rise of the Royal Society or the hiring of intellectuals in courts, etc. The state started to kind of subsidize research at a very early stage, whereas our rulers were building Taj Mahals and not really developing any intellectual research or discussion. How would you react to that?
I'm familiar with My point is that both China and India, in a sense, had a resource curse. In this instance, it was not oil; it was land. Agrarian empires. They were thriving agrarian empires with long distance trade, and so, unlike Britain, unlike certainly the United Kingdom, where land shortage and the availability of coal made the discovery of steam possible, they arrived in India. They discovered textiles and sold them in Europe for great profits. Then discovered that they could make them themselves. So they stole the technology from India and China and went back and developed them under state auspices. So, I mean, in many ways here, necessity was the mother of invention, whereas China and India were already sort of towering powers at the stage. And that's where they picked out. To say that there was no intellectual production in India and China during the 16th and the 17th century, I think is false. It may not be of quite the order that counts for a technocratic vision of the world. But then again, I think you need to understand the different contexts of India, China, which, as I'm sure you no doubt know, accounted at that stage for nearly two-thirds of GDP, the world GDP. And it's only the last 200 years that this has changed, and it changed for Europe largely because of Europe's use of military prowess and outright colonization and utilization of other people's resources to develop. So I don't think you can exclude that. That too is part of the intellectual debate.
But Aisha, let me just to explore this further. Isn't it also, I mean, the way that, again, I've seen it talked about and written, that part of the reason that Europe conquered the rest of the world is that, again, it's partly, they discovered technology, but partly also because they discovered the scientific method early on, and they discovered the ability to be disciplined, you know, just work in teams better than us, and be able to, the other thing that they discovered very early on is that they started exploring the world, discovered navigation. And we really, because we had plenty, because yes, we were well fed and well looked after, and we had the resource curse, we really didn't go in those directions. For example, India, the Indian subcontinent, is probably the largest coastline of any country, but yet the coastline did not lead us to go out exploring the world. And we did.
There was no navy. The Mughals didn't develop a navy. Look what the Chinese did in Zhonghe in the early 15th century, in the Ming period, sent out expeditions and then wrapped them up. So, I don't deny that difference. But Europe's success cannot be explained without the discovery of the New World and its resources, and then the slave trade, and then, I mean, you know, it goes on and on, and we need 5 hours to talk.
Enough. I appreciate that. The last thing that I want to draw out, a couple of things I want to draw out from this is that if we take that debate further and we say, okay, it was the intellectual ferment in Europe, and it was the ability to develop new ideas, not just discover technology, but develop new ideas on how to organize society and how to organize production and how to, you know, organize the army, etc. That new thinking, and discover the scientific method, which is very important, and to be able to run with the scientific method. Those things, we, I think, in Pakistan still have not adopted. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think what was significant about Britain in particular, because the Industrial Revolution, after all, came there first, was state support for industrial development. Why? Because there was a craze, as I already pointed out, for textiles and many other products, and they wanted to turn that the tables around. So state support was given for these sorts of discoveries, not just, you know, conspicuous consumption or the building of grand architecture. What was being done in Britain was that, I mean, the whole idea of the modern state emerges out of the mercantilist requirements at that stage. So I do think that those are points that we've missed out on, the absence of state encouragement. I'm sure there is state encouragement for nuclear technology and what the state thinks are security-related technologies. But across the board, and not to mention, I want to come at a much more basic point, the complete destruction of the educational system and the persistence with rote learning as opposed to analytical and creative thinking, mm-hmm. that is the source of our malaise. Mm-hmm. That is why Pakistan has not been able to get out. I mean, just consider, I mean, you know, it's so frustrating. Most of your students are only accustomed to rote learning, not to think for themselves. Mm. Thinking is not encouraged.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the problem.
Fascinating. Aisha, just before we close, let me ask you one important question that I ask most people of your eminence. One is that, please guide our students who are interested in doing historical research. Give some ideas on how they should be thinking. What topics, for example, I mean, it's up to you, you decide. What topics they should be thinking about? How should they be thinking about historical research? How is it that they should go about doing historical research?
Well, I mean, I'll tell you one thing, talking to an economist, mm-hmm. And with great respect to our Pakistan has produced some excellent economists. I think what we need desperately amongst many other aspects of history covered is a solid economic history mm-hmm. of the region that is Pakistan. Mm-hmm. It still needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a big something that's missing.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of questions, there are enormous questions mm-hmm. To ask. Basically, we need a team of people to do historical research, because history, unfortunately, in this country is seen as something about dates and names, mm-hmm. Or just about the past. History is a method to make better sense of our present and future. And I think this is what I would say, that the questions they ask have to be very important. You have to ask a good question.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, I mean, there are innumerable questions to ask, but I think historical research is required in order for us to get a better handle on our present predicament and chart out a future that is healthier and better for all of us.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, is one thing that I feel that will handicap historical research a lot is that in the post-colonial period, is there enough sort of historical evidence that the government has revealed, for example? Do we get...
Absolutely. That's a superb question. I mean, that is the great tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that the absence of government support, I mean, every single document is treated by bureaucrats, archival bureaucrats, as state secrets.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, scholars are given a very rough time mm-hmm. in trying to get any kind of information. But there's a world out there.
Mm-hmm.
And you can still do research,
mm-hmm.
And there are ways and means to do it. I think quite apart from not opening archival materials or documenting properly, because, I mean, the lack of a historical consciousness in Pakistan is most evident in the fact that we don't really collect material. We just have no sort of sense of the importance of history.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, countries without a history are countries that are lost.
Right.
And that's what Pakistan is. Country. So I would say that they need to do more historically engaged research, and that will illuminate some of the problems of our present, or even make better sense of them and enable us to find solutions to the future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, do you get enough Pakistani students to come and do historical research with you, or is that something, again, that we need to kind of encourage students to take up the subject?
Well, I'm working on that, Nadeem. One of the reasons I come to teach in Pakistan at LUMS and will do so in other places is to identify potential graduate students with whom I can work.
Mm-hmm.
I currently have two excellent graduate students from Pakistan working with me, and I hope that that will increase in the years to come.
Great. Now, finally, is there a book that you'd like to recommend our kids to read that you think is absolutely indispensable to their sort of education?
There's not one book.
Mm-hmm.
There are many, many books. But tell me what kind of a book you're talking about.
I'm just saying that all Pakistani kids, just referring to kids in general, because I want kids to broaden their reading. When I go to universities and ask kids, kids are not reading. And I want them to, guests to tell them that, hey, you must read, and point out some key books. You can point out one or two or three, doesn't matter. I mean, I'm not asking you to restrict yourself to one. But give us a reading list, because I don't think kids have that access to get a good reading list from people.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it'll all be very much in terms of what I'm reading now or have taught recently. I just finished teaching a course. And I think two things there. One book that, I mean, first of all, I think they should read Modern South Asia, jointly written by me and Sugatha Books, which at least grounds them into history. But that would be for an undergraduate audience, not for, you know, school children.
Sure.
But I also think that we need to understand, you know, one of the ways to understand Pakistan and to do history for Pakistan in the future is to locate Pakistan globally, to understand what's happening more broadly in the world. In that context, I would recommend a couple of books. One is, I think, the Empire of Cotton by Sven Beckett is a very important book for Pakistanis to read and grasp. The ways in which Europe or Britain in particular turned the tables on India's textile industry is something that really is worth reading. I also enjoyed very much my own colleague, who's not a historian, Lisa Lowe, her book called The Intimacy of Four Continents, in which she shows how America, the Caribbean, Africa, and Asia, and Europe are all connected to the slave trade. And I think that these interconnections are very important for them to learn. So connected histories is where I would take them. In other words, that even Pakistan's own history and this region's own history has to be seen increasingly in connected manner. That's what I'm working towards now. So those books, and what else? Well, I mean, they're just innumerable books. I mean, I can't really. It depends on the topic that I would. Historically, I would say they should read these works because that will just open up many sort of vistas for them. I would like to add Ken Pomeranz, but it's a difficult read. The Great Convergence. So they need to read books that ask the large questions. That's what I would say.
Thank you, Aisha. I think that's a very good way to finish. I think, quite frankly, throughout my educational career, I've seen, and I see many of us suffer from this, the last point that you raised, the large question. I think we are, I don't know what it is, we are very diffident in asking big questions.
No, the tragedy is that I notice a tendency amongst Pakistani scholars and younger people to ask very specific localized questions. Now, there's nothing wrong in that, but so long as the local is intermeshed with the regional and the global,
that's right. That's
I think that is what to, so not to sort of completely sort of, you know, go into disarray and not ground yourself, but I think you have to understand that there's a connected world we live in, and nothing that happens in Gujranwala is unconnected with what's happening at the national or the regional or the global level. That's the challenge
that they have to. Excellent point. And I think, again, in that, one thing that, again, last thing that I think you probably also should tell, like, is that, look, guys, you can do it. You can also think big, and you can also do research and publish overseas, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you,
Aisha. This was wonderful. I will call on you sometime again because I think we need to do this a lot more. I think it's wonderful, but thanks for giving us your time.
All right.
Soch Bachar ke saath, mera naam Nadeem Ul Haq hai. Aur mera naam Anjum Altaf hai.